am Cheryl Stewart. I'm currently the coordinator of Lutheran Campus Ministry at the community colleges in the city of Chicago. And I am teaching this next week here a course on Black female spirituality. I'm going to do this in two sections, section A tonight and section B tomorrow morning, and then we'll repeat it next week. I'd like to begin by just talking for a few minutes about spirituality. It seems that in the past few years, the word spirituality has kind of blossomed and mushroomed. And I think it's always appropriate then to ask the question, why? Why spirituality now? As Lutherans, we really haven't ever addressed this topic of spirituality up until recently. My exposure to spirituality in my seminary training was because of my Roman Catholic friends. I did not go to a Lutheran seminary. I went to a UCC and a Baptist seminary, American Baptist. And the third largest population on campus after the UCCs and the Baptists were the Roman Catholics. So by the grace of God, I had an exposure to spirituality which I have not seen duplicated yet in Lutheran seminaries. We're starting to address it, and that's very, very good. But the question of why spirituality still remains. Spirituality is a very conscious reflection on God's presence and God's action in our lives. God does things that we don't understand. God does things that we don't like. God does things that make us say, take back the gift of life you've given me. But we are called to still reflect and learn and grow from all the actions that God takes. Spirituality has to do with how and what God communicates with us, how the Bible informs and interprets God's communication, how other human beings in the past have understood, interpreted, and responded to what God has communicated, so that spirituality is almost a discipline in and of itself. In most discussions of spirituality, we go back to the mystics, to the medieval times, and we talk about Merton, Thomas Merton, who was a tremendous mystic. But very seldom do we hear any discussion of Black people who were mystics. Part of the question of why spirituality, and a smaller question except to say it must be addressed alongside of it, is why Black spirituality? Why spirituality has to do with all of Christianity, all of Christendom, all of God's children? Why Black spirituality has to do with the same group of people? The thing is, the difference, the qualitative difference, is that when we talk about Black spirituality, we reflect on the Black experience, the Black culture, the Black understanding of God, the Black revelation of God, which is different. And that's a God-given gift. So when we talk about Black spirituality, we include people like Howard Thurman, who up until a few years ago when he died, was one of the great mystics of the 20th century. He was a Black man. But we don't learn about them in seminaries unless we have a Pete Perro or a Rudy Featherstone or a Jim Eccles teaching at the seminary who have been able to research and learn and grow and reflect on what Howard Thurman experienced 50 years before we came along so that he can help to clarify the way we see things happening, the way we understand how God operates. The next issue that we posit alongside why spirituality and why Black spirituality is why female spirituality. Now, in a joking way, there is a female culture, except to say that that's very, very serious. Women and men do think differently, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. We reason in a little different way. There's nothing wrong with that. Together we make a whole. Without each other, we're isolated. It's kind of like black and white. Living and surviving in separate societies and separate cultures, we're not whole without one another. And therefore, when we come together and put these pieces together, we have much more of a glimpse of what that kingdom is all about and what we are about as children of God, as kingdom builders. So the question then, why black female spirituality, is a crucial question for all women. We have something to share with you as black women and white women. We have something to share with Hispanic women and Native American women and Asian women. We have something to share. You also have something to give us. But we've got to dialogue about that. We've got to explore it. We've got to do some research. We've got to do some writing. We've got to share it. This is an attempt then to begin, hopefully to initiate that whole process. I'm going to, and I hope this is not too boring. I thought that the historical overview was summed up very well in this book, Black Women in 19th Century American Life. I am going to read from it. And I hope that my reading is lively and not boring. But I do ask you to be patient. Slavery assumes white superiority. Long after emancipation, feelings of inferiority were part of the black cultural inheritance. In the study of black women, there is a latent hypothesis which aids in understanding how some were able to salvage themselves from the incubus of slavery and from the later abasement of racism. Psychic wholeness, the evidence suggests, stemmed from a two-stage process. Fundamental was the childhood experience of being loved. But the precarious world of slavery and its aftermath made necessary a symbolism extension of this experience. Therefore, it was crucial to the individual to acquire and absorb enduring concepts capable of replenishing a sense of worthiness and love. Numberless black women in surroundings often barren and cruel wrought creative miracles by providing such sustenance for themselves and for their children. The second thing that is absolutely necessary is having a psychological center. From this point, a person may take soundings, establish direction, and discern the self. Slavery as a system endowed the acts of men, and this is, I'm reading from this book, this is not my language, this is the author's language. Slavery as a system endowed the acts of men with the force of acts of God. Under such a system, the social and cultural patterns of humanity evolved to shelter the human spirit against the natural calamities of life and death were warped. A normal progression toward wholeness, the interior process of becoming, was jeopardized by the absence of any psychological center. Slavery did not preclude the emergence of richly creative personalities. For religion, surrogate parents and culture did exist among the slaves. But the possibilities of cultivating internal strength, if not withered, were curbed by servility and fear. Religion, then, was pivotal to black American life. Womanhood in each of its phases was sanctioned by religious values. The religious experience was a group heritage and a creative personal impetus. At once secular and holy, a religious sentiment suffused black thought and generated a dynamic for black action. Religion was a hardy fixed point in a social universe of uncontrollable flux. Human beings cannot live with flux alone. There must be points of departure and return to permit survival of the psyche. Men and women in slave society found meanings in the promises of scripture. They became one with the Christian epic. The promise of Christianity permeates Afro-American culture. The moving words of song and spiritual and the rich imagery of Christianity gave countless slaves communion with imperishable stability. ritual anchored fear and gave men and women the courage to dream, a Bible reading by a parent later remembered, a furtive prayer recited together merged God's blessing with parental love. Enforced obedience to a cruel earthly master meant emotional bondage. Voluntary obedience to a beneficent heavenly master offered redemption. Each kind of service imposed burdens, but the act of choosing, the liberty to be able to choose, gives each person a sense of relief and a sense of mission. Faith in divine guidance and purpose alone made grief bearable and softened the traumas of parting. Guilt and redemption were doctrines all the more satisfying because of the desperate need for acknowledgement as a person. A private world inside the self, sustained by religious sentiment and religious symbolism, was fashioned then to contain the world without. The faith, the feelings, the language of biblical Christianity explained existence, forged attitudes, and conditioned behavior. They gave to black men and black women such tranquility and dignity as people deprived of humanity by law and cultural pressure can attain. Religion was basically Christian, Protestant, and evangelical. After emancipation, black religious thought moved north with the black migration, which is still continuing in some measure, although a reversal of this pattern may now be underway. Black women of the 19th century in leadership positions who lectured, wrote, and agitated were the legatees of this tradition and its trustees. The oneness of humanity derived from the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. We understand what they're trying to communicate. Abolition of slavery was part of the black religion of the antebellum South. It was an unspoken prayer, an arsenal of faith. Black women then were important carriers of black culture. They transmitted its message in the haunting music and inspiring lyrics of folk songs and the homely maxims of folk wisdom. They interpreted the anxieties of present life against the background of theology and heralded the future in the liturgy of fervent belief. Black women who spoke from the lecture platform or from the pages of books and essays emphasized, though mainly in secular terms, an almost identical code. They reared their children in the idiom of the Christian faith. As defenders of human dignity and human equality, they grounded their argument in appeals to religious sanctions. Their values were those of the Western world, the ethical principles of the Judaic Christian lineage. The black woman, says a sociologist, Jesse Bernard, has borne the major burden of the race to help children to survive in a precarious world, to provide the inner strength they would need in their unknown future. Symbols of stability had to be contrived. Impoverished women, denied life's comforts and society's conventional supports, were often sufficiently inventive to improvise the solutions to this basic human problem. That, as a not-so-brief introduction, kind of sets the tone for the discussion then. What we've heard is that somehow, somewhere along the way, religion provided the basis for black woman's spirituality. Spirituality being understanding why God allowed this suffering to happen. And that spirituality has been passed on. The question that I want to discuss with my black sisters and my white sisters now is, where do we go with this? And in order to go with it, let's unpack it. That's the second part of today. The topic of images becomes very, very key. Images communicate sometimes very positive things, sometimes very negative things. What do I mean when I talk about images? For instance, what does the symbol of a cross convey? And Susan, maybe you can help me out here. What does the symbol, the image of a cross convey to people who have been abused and exploited by the church in Latin America. Maybe we don't have to go as far as Latin America. It could be the South during the 50s and the 40s. But I know that in Latin America and Central America too, there is that conflict of images where we sometimes perceive the cross as a liberating symbol, others perceive it as oppressive. Am I right or wrong in that?
I think you're right in that it does have conflicting images. I think one of the main things I think when I think of the cross in Latin America is our often misinterpretation of a crucifix. And the crucifix is a powerful image of hope for people in Latin America. And oftentimes in our culture, I see us looking at it as a sign that Latin Americans see only crucifixion and death and don't see hope. Because we've been taught that the empty cross is the ultimate sign of hope and triumph, whereas for people who are suffering in Latin America, Christ on the cross is one of the most intimate symbols of accompaniment in their suffering. And so I don't think I'm speaking exactly in the way you asked it. But
this is important discussion too.
Right, raising the image of the cross, that's the first thing that comes to me in terms of some cross-cultural kinds of misunderstandings.
That's right. And you know, as I was saying, in the 40s and the 50s, a burning cross on the lawn of a black family was a very negative, destructive image. And it's those images that communicate, and they communicate good things and they communicate bad things. Artifacts communicate things. When I see a picture of a Scandinavian Jesus, I have problems. And that is an image that is projected. When children, black kids, are asked to draw a picture of God, there is this white man with a long white beard. That is an image they have of God, the all-powerful, the omniscient, all the alls. And that to me says, well, what about their own self-image? If the white symbol, if the white image is the powerful image, what is it all about? And what are they holding up as their standards? Who are they trying to become? That's the question of the images. Images are cultural expressions of value systems. They are the cultural expressions of standards of acceptability and standards of rejectability. If you dress in a certain way, if you use your knife and fork and do it in the right manner, 3 forks and 2 knives and 5 spoons, if you do it in the right way, you're acceptable. If you speak properly, you're acceptable. What does properly mean? But those are all images which are translated. The controversy about black English in schools in Michigan, was it? That whole controversy was that was a cultural controversy. Images, what is being passed on? What are we communicating? Images have something to do with our own self-image too. We drew pictures today in art, and I had a very difficult time figuring out how to draw curly hair. I mean, it just didn't look right. It didn't look like me. Didn't look like my black brothers and sisters either. My self-image is called into question. My self-image has to do with light skin, straight noses, straight hair, thin lips. In Ebony, this past issue of Ebony, they had the 10 most beautiful black women. Lena Horne, Cheri Belafonte, a previous Miss America, Diane Carroll, every last woman looked like y'all. What does that say to me? Cleopatra was Elizabeth Taylor. That is problematic because that's the image we are giving our kids. That's who they must become in order to succeed. Do you understand what I'm saying? Look at television commercials. They finally realize that black people clean their teeth. Now, you know that's a shame in 1984 or whenever they first started realizing that. Black people do wash their kitchen floors. But it's things like that that project images that affect our kids and their self-images. I'm going to read another thing, but you are familiar with this one. This is Sojourner Truth. It talks about images. And then we're going to watch Whoopi Goldberg and how she discusses self-image. And then I'm going to, if we have enough time left, I'm compacting four sessions, two sessions in one today. Four sessions in two today and tomorrow. So I hope we'll have time to discuss some of the things. Sojourner Truth. Find the right page. And this speech of hers is called, Ain't I a Woman? Well, children, when there is so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. I think that twixt the Negroes of the South and the women at the North, all talking about rights, the white man will be in a fix pretty soon. But what's all this here talking about? That man over there says women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best places everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me any best place, and ain't I a woman? Look at me. Look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns, and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as a man when I could get it, and bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children and seen most of them sold off to slavery, and when I cried out with a mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me, and ain't I a woman? Then they talk about this thing in the head. What's that they call it? Intellect. That's it, honey. What's that got to do with woman's rights or Negro rights? If my cup won't hold but a pint and yours holds a quart, wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? Then that little man in black over there, he says, woman can't have as much rights as men because Christ wasn't a woman. Sound familiar? Where did your Christ come from? Where did your Christ come from? From God and a woman. Man had absolutely nothing to do with that. If the first woman God ever made was strong enough, as they have told us, to turn the world upside down all alone, these women together ought to be able to turn it back and get it right side up again. And now they're asking to do it. The men had better let them. That was spoken many, many years ago. Obviously in the 18th century, it seems to me it was about 1851, so the middle of the 18th century. At a suffragette meeting, right. There's some rich stuff that we have, and you know, part of our confusion today as black women, I think, has to do with the women's movement and whether the women are speaking for all women or whether white women in the women's movement are speaking for white women in the women's movement. And that's part of our confusion, because I am afraid to say that there are certain things you can't say for me. And that's just the name of that tune. We're going to look at Whoopi Goldberg now, and then we will open this up for discussion. Somebody help me open the TVs, please.
Is it pretty?
Yeah.
I could put it in a ponytail, want to see?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, let me get off my shoulder, wait. See, look, see? And look, now it's in my eyes. And my mother made me go to my room because she said it's wearing my shirt on my head. And I said, nah, this is my long, luxurious blonde hair. And she said, nah, fool, that's your shirt. And I said, you a fool, this is my hair. And she made me go to my room. But I don't care, because when I get big, I'm going to get 50 million, 20 million, elephants, and I'm letting go in the house. They can trample on everybody. And then she going to want me to make them stop, but she ain't even going to know I'm there, because I'm going to have blonde hair, blue eyes, and I'm going to be white. I am. But they said on TV, all you gotta do is go to the optometrist's office, and he got blue eyes in his desk drawer. And then I'm gonna have a dream house, and a dream car, and dream candy, and a dream horse, and me and Bobby gonna live together with Ken and Skipper and Malibu Bob. We are. And then we're gonna buy sight clothes, cause we wanna go somewhere, cause we wanna go somewhere sight, cause we wanna get on the love boat. But you gotta have long hair to get on the love boat. Like that lady on TV who live in that big house, you know that lady? And then a big old car drives up, ain't nobody even driving in the car, so some tap dancers shooting. And then the tap dancers shooting get out, and they tap dance up the walkway, and they tap dance up the side of the door, and they ring the doorbell. And then they tap dance back down, and then the lady opened the door, she ain't even surprising nobody in them shoes. And then they tap dance up in the car, and they drive away. And I want that to happen to me, but you still gotta have long hair. And I told my mother I didn't want to be black no more. I did. But she don't never do nothing at sight. She just go to work all the time. She work on Wall Street. That's all she do, work, work, work. And she don't even know nobody's sight. And nobody's sight know her. And she don't even look like nobody on TV, not even on the Justice League, not even on the Smurfs. She says she don't want to look like no damn Then she said, even if you sit in the back of the car to help these over, you ain't gonna be nothing but black. And she was right, because I sat in the car and I got burned. And she said, I just had to be happy with what I got. But look, see, it don't do nothing. It don't blow in the wind.
It don't blow.
And it don't cast cascadine down my back. And don't, and I put that down to that behavior stuff, and then it didn't even listen. And I want some other kind of hair to do something else. I do. Hi. You got hair like mine, huh? How come you don't have your shirt on? You came outside without it? Nobody said nothing? No. I touch your hair? Huh? Well, look, a sticky one. I use the other hand. Well, your hair is soft. My hair is soft too, still. It's dusty, but it's soft. Them your friends? You don't care, you don't have no shirt on this day? How old are you?
35.
I'm gonna be 7 on Wednesday. Yeah, thank you. I'm big for my age, because you live near nuclear rock. My granny said we have to move soon, or we all gonna glow in the dark. She got that kind of hair too. Is that your hair? On the top? Somebody in your family look like me? Is this naturally like that? I guess nobody looks like you on TV neither, huh? And she got it, and he got it, and nobody got no shirt on. And know nobody on TV look like none of y'all. Well, who do those people look like? Huh?
Oh, my.
See, maybe I don't even have to wear no shirt on my head. Then if I'm lucky, I'll grow up and be cute. I'll be cute like you, and I don't even care if I look like you. Except I don't want no mustache, because my Aunt Ernestine got a mustache. We're not supposed to talk about it. So look, see? I put it way over there. See, I'm not thinking about it, see? I'm not. I'm thinking about something else. Anybody, huh? Candy. And I'm thinking about the new edition. And I think about all the new clothes my granny got me, because she got me new shoes and new stockings. And she got me a brand new shirt that I was supposed to hang up.
Standards of acceptability and values. That's how I'd say it. In other words, if black women are inside themselves seeking to become white, as Whoopi ironically or humorously, you know, suggested, then what does that say about our relationship with God? If then, to me, that says that we're saying to God, we do not like the person you made. And the society says we have to reject the person you made, God, in order to be acceptable. But what does the history of our interaction with God as black women, how does that inform this kind of dialogue? And that's why I was going back to Sojourner, to call back to the fact that this struggle is not new in 1987. It's been going on, and where are we going with it? What are we passing on to our younger black women? That their acceptability has something to do with putting caustic creams on their heads in order to get straight, cascading hair. You know, is that what it is? And those other kinds of things that if their features happen to be African, they are not acceptable. And how do we relate that to God? Because I think it is directly related to God. Okay.
But I think what I was thinking of was that society has the expectation that, since you're specifically talking about black women, that black women have to conform to a white standard of acceptability to be acceptable.
And that's why I assume we're here on the mountaintop for this rainbow thing, to start exploding that, blowing it wide open, and choosing to operate in some other ways. Yes, to answer your question directly. When we get down in the valley, there's some demonic stuff that's going to pressure us into being less than who God created us to be. How are we going to handle it as the salt of the earth, as the light of the world? And I assume that's why we're all here, because we are the salt of the earth and the light of the world.
I guess specifically in terms of in parishes, what can be done when dealing with black boys and girls to let them know that who they are and what they are is perfect as they are? Besides saying that, what else? I mean, okay, like one of the things you mentioned was having, for instance, literature related to the black culture available to use. But what else specifically?
I want to open it up. This is not just a dialogue between you and me. I would like some other people. I know.
It seems to me the problem is not only the society sets standards for acceptability for black women, it sets standards for acceptability for white women, and for white men, and for everybody. I mean, how many of us are twiddies, or, you know, whatever has to fit the current model to change up and down? None of us do. There aren't any winners in American society. So we're arguing with the whole concept of there being winners.
Or those who have succeeded.
Yeah. Well, winners, really. We're our children are all taught to be winners. That's what we are all taught to strive to be. You're right. Not really. When you reach the top of the heap, fall downhill. Nobody ever really gets to the top and stays there. You're either scrambling up and crushing people in the process, or they're sliding down, and that's the end of them. And of course, we all know it's going to happen to them. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to look at reality in an entirely different way. Like you said, the way God made it.
I'm really interested in the work you do in where you are, the spirituality you teach.
How do I transmit that to the people that I campus pastor?
You're a campus pastor?
I'm a campus pastor. I'm responsible for the ministry at Loop College on the north side of the Loop in the city of Chicago, which is a community college. It has a population of about 10,000. About 2,000 are international foreign students. And of the other 8,000, about 4/5 are black. And the kind of ministry I have is not a traditional campus ministry, obviously, because of the transience of the population, because they're commuter. And the other reason that it's a transient population is because it's a community college. It's only 2 years. It's a junior college. So the kind of images that I attempt to transmit has something to do with my modeling behavior and not necessarily preaching or, you know, direct teaching. It has to do with modeling and being proud of the fact that God made me the way God made me, and God did not make a mistake. And just transmitting that. And some people would point at that, I suppose, and call it moral or cultural arrogance, because I don't apologize for what God did, because I don't think people have a problem with me as much as they have a problem with God. That's really the a lot of what my ministry is about. Projecting myself not only as a black woman, but as a pastor. Because black woman pastors, there are 15 of us, Max, in all of Lutheranism, and our history started in 1979. So we do not have a 10-year history in the church yet. And so that's kind of what my ministry is. It's transmitting to our black youth that it is possible to be a pastor, to be a human being, to be feminine, to be regular, and to love them, and to always reflect God inside of us. And you can check with Simone and see if I've given her any of that over the years. To call you all into honesty with God and you know, with one another and with our community of black women, I think that that's very, very crucial. Because I think if we go on this way, we're just going to have black women and white women, and I don't want to speak for the other women of color, but we're going to have 5 separate women's caucuses. And I don't think that's necessary. But it's, so that to me is ministry. Okay.
That's great.
Long-winded answer.
Cheryl, I think all of us are guilty of not speaking out against what happens on TV. We all are upset about various different things on TV. The fact that blacks are not represented, the fact that there's too much violence on TV, the fact that there's not enough children's programs, all of these things. I look at the TV and I think, ooh, this is awful, and turn it off, but I don't write and call and tell the right person that I'm upset about this.
Mm-hmm. You can always start. I did that with NBC, and I have no idea if it makes it's going to make a difference in that. But you tell them you're not watching our programs, you're going to appreciate their commercials, and tell them why. And I have found that just making a little, making my voice heard does change things sometimes. It does.
Sometimes we think that one voice really doesn't make a difference.
Yes.
But it does.
It's the only thing that
matters. So Cheryl, I'm trying to work on my understanding now is that before we can achieve that spirituality that will help us to be ourselves, we've got to at least know who we are before we can.
That's right. Or whose we are. Maybe we need to get in touch with God before we can understand whose we are and who we are. And get that alignment going. That's right. And then we line up with the ancestors. And that's why I went back to the 19th century. I think that in this society, it does. I think that what we're working towards is that it shouldn't. But I think that the way we are perceived and the way we, as a consequence, perceive ourselves.
When I'm speaking of a person's personal image or the way they choose to look, has anything to do with their personal spirituality, not the way someone else perceives them. Because I think that's the only thing that's important.
How you...
Right.
Well, but I understand what you're saying. And I think the only thing that I would get concerned about is that the question I'd ask is that connected with the rest of the community? Or is that an individualistic attempt to deal with it? And if it's not connected with the community, then I would have some questions. Because I think that the community has an awful lot of influence on us, and to disconnect ourselves from the community, from the ancestors, and the continuity, from the future, from the Christ is the memory of the future, you know, that thing, to try and do something individualistically is not being faithful to God.
Yeah, I don't think you understand the question. You mentioned using chemicals to straighten the hair, or what else? Well, I can't remember what you said. I'm saying is, do you think because a person does that, it reduces their spirituality?
No. I'll say no, but I think that they have to examine why they're doing that. And that's what I'm saying.
Maybe it's easy to take care of their hair.
But is that saying that then that what God gave you was wrong?
No.
See, that's what I mean. I'd have to ask why they're doing that. Then if what God gave you originally wasn't wrong, why are you changing it?
Because it's easy to deal with it.
But that's saying that what God gave you was not adequate.
I'm sitting here thinking of a particular woman, not necessarily me, but one that I read with, who happened not to really know her heritage. Other than she knows that she's biracial. What two races, she's not sure. She's very light complexion, and she has reddish blonde hair. Her hair gets blonder in summer, okay? Her hair is extremely kinky. So in order, growing up in an orphanage, in order to fit in, she tried to dye her hair black. Now, the black women here know there's nothing worse than blonde hair to try and dye black as kinky. I mean, that's like going the other way. You know, black hair is kinky to be trying to dye blonde.
Really?
I think Vivian knows who I'm talking about. I cannot think of anyone any more spiritual than this particular woman, because if anyone could say, I came this far by faith, I think she could. I don't really see that because she chose to put a relaxer on her hair and leave it blonde, that it changed her image of herself or her spirituality.
I don't see how cosmetic kind of things can change a person's image of themselves, the image that they want to portray, or the image that anyone else sees.
I think that's easy in this society to perceive it that way, that it really has no effect on spirituality. It's very easy in the United States. We were in Africa last summer. And if she were in Africa, she'd have a total different cultural perspective. And that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. This society, this culture affects us in a certain way. That's all I'm saying. I straighten my hair.
No, I mean, but there's some, the same way one would be affected. Yeah. Only because everybody in there is doing the same.
Somebody else help me then. If I'm not answering the question, somebody else help me.
Well, I think there's an attempt to separate, which is an un-African traditional thing. There's an attempt to separate the person from the spirit. There is a possibility that that's what you are discussing. And in one culture, that's what folk want you to do. And in another culture, that's a no-no. So, you know, so some kind of way you kind of get to those things. So you're raising a significant question. And I would like to turn it around and say, why isn't it that whites wouldn't desire, almost to a person, white women, to make their hair look like African or black hair?
They do.
That's why I said at one point that it really has nothing to do with spirituality except to say we're talking about particular societies and cultures, and that does affect our images, self-images, and our the images we have of others.
Yeah, I guess sun tanning is like that too.
Miriam wants to.
A number of well-known vocal artists who have changed surgically, you know, plastic surgery, their noses, the entire Jackson family, the Jackson 5.
Yeah.
Who else? I know you can name, I don't know, at least 20 of them. Patti LaBelle.
Mm-hmm.
I could just go on and on.
A lot of
to get a keen nose.
That's
to
right.
Be physically more acceptable before the eye of the public. I mean, Michael Jackson, I think he must have had, I don't know how many nose jobs because they didn't get it right, and he was out of the public eye for a long time, you know, had all kind of other health problems related to him trying to change his physical appearance.
In order to be acceptable.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I think what she's saying is that,
I was saying that's one.
I wasn't dealing with what she was saying. I just wanted to interject something.
That's one of the things that this might be one of the things that prevents us from being close to God.
Yeah.
But I think Cheryl has talked about owning our past, owning the pain and suffering. You know, knowing who we are inside, and the physical thing just might be one thing, just one of the things that's keeping us from having a closer spirituality.
I don't really have long, kinky hair.
Mm-hmm.
My hair originally was to my waist, it was like a brush.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and no way in the world I would walk around like this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I lived in Africa, yeah, mm-hmm. You know, the bugs and stuff get in here. Mm-hmm.
Think that they put a blonde streak in their hair and, you know,
what they call the thing that they do, you know, cut it in the wedge and all that, might make them more acceptable. Mm-hmm. But I really don't think black women as a whole, my generation, mm-hmm. I don't know how Cheryl is, I don't think what black women of my generation are that big minded.
I think I would, let me just interject one comment. I was using that as an example. I'm not limiting it to that. I also mentioned the way you eat, the way you dress, the kind of education you have. All of those things have something to do with it. And I didn't mean to use just that one and to take that to the, you know, to use that as the barometer. That's just a, you know, an example.
But I think you almost have to qualify your statement because the generation of changes and differences. Okay, and also family background. You know, what did your parents, what did your mother and your grandmother and your aunt tell you about being a black woman?
Not too much, frankly. I had to learn it from some other people because my folks are from Jamaica. And they are West Indian women, which is very different from black American women. And so that was a whole other. That's right.
You know, I don't care where you come from, if your skin is dark or black. But what I'm saying is, I think some of the things that we're talking about have generational boundaries.
I don't know. Not if what Sojourner Truth said in 1850s. Still stands, still rings true, and I think it does. I think there's some universals that go from generation to generation, and the standards of acceptability change.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm agreeing with you. We're not disagreeing. I'm saying that standards of acceptability vary from culture to culture. There is, you know, in the United States, there's certain things. In other cultures, there are other things. And we have to dialogue about all of them and find what is really, after all of that stuff has been stripped away, what is the essence? What is the bottom line? What's most important? Okay? I don't think we disagree.
Time?
Time. We'll continue this tomorrow.